On today's episode of The Good Word, we have trust issues with the Clippers. It's Jokic and Giannis for the best player of this generation. And we geek out over some of our favorite college basketball players of all time. All that and much more on today's episode.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports. Ball don't lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. We are part of the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Get us wherever you get your podcast. Get comfortable with this guest because he's going to be with us every other Wednesday. His name is Tom Haberstroh. He worked everywhere. He worked with Bleacher. He worked with ESPN, NBC. He is now proprietor of the Substack, TomTheFinder.com. And of course, he is also an analytics insider for the Portland Trail Blazers, their broadcast team, of course. So Tom is blazing all types of trails, and he's now a contributor with us here at Yahoo Sports. Tom, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Great to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
Dog, we are going to have some fun every other Wednesday. Today, we're going to get into why scoring has gone down since the All-Star break and maybe a battle for best player of this generation. But first, we have to go with our trust issues with the Los Angeles Clippers. I don't know if you have trust issues with the Clippers, Tom, but I do. And they were up 20 and wound up losing by 20 to the Minnesota Timberwolves, a team that they cannot seem to handle at all this year. Kawhi Leonard, he left the game last night with back spasms. Naz Reid tweaked his ankle. Rudy Gobert, he came down with a rib injury possibly after I don't know what the hell he was doing on that play. That's one of those what the hell are you doing on that play thing when you're 7'4", you don't got to jump and lunge at someone. But, you know, be that as it may, is that last night more about the maturity of the Timberwolves, the versatility of them, and the growth of Anthony Edwards on both ends of the floor? Or is this just about our trust issues with the LA Clippers?
Yeah, it's the trust issues with their health. I mean, when Kawhi left the game changed. And he left with back spasms. And Vinny, you know this. It's weird when a guy leaves the arena straight up, like middle of the game, just gone. Kawhi is a weird dude, but I didn't expect that to happen where, yeah, he had back spasms. But he leaves the arena in the middle of the game, and it's kind of like this controversy. Like, wait, did he just get up out of here? And so that's not a good sign, especially because they've been so healthy this year, Vinny. Like, we talk about the Clippers, and Clippers going clip, right? And it's usually about we can't depend on those guys showing up when it matters most because they get injured all the time. And Paul George and Kawhi Leonard have been exceptionally healthy this year. The NBA put in that player participation policy, and by and large, it's been a success because when you look at Kawhi Leonard and PG, they've been playing. Mm-hmm. And with the exception of last night, it felt like they have had health on their side this year. But once Kawhi left, how many times are we going to see a team go up by 20 and then go down by 20 in the same game? That almost never happens. And as much as I want to say this is about Clippers or roster construction or just trust issues, it really is to me. If they don't have Kawhi, they're cooked. Kawhi's been unbelievable this year when he's been playing, and they lose Russell Westbrook. They lose Kawhi Leonard last night. And so for me, it's like, all right, Clippers, when they're all healthy and together, great. But as we saw with the Brooklyn Nets last year or in the years prior, once we get these super teams together and they're at a certain age, my trust issues are really about availability.
I think that's the big thing you just said. They're at a certain age. Like, I wonder if it's partially because LeBron James is 85 years old and we all expect every superstar to age like that. But these dudes have a lot of tread on their tires and a lot of injuries and a lot of atrophy, including James Harden, who has a lot of minutes on his body. And I think he has, shall we say, city minutes on his body, not highway minutes on his body. Yeah, it's a little different there. And the big thing for me, Tom, coming into this season was the Clippers have to be healthy. Last year, they weren't healthy at all, and they were the 5 seed. This year, they're healthy and playing well, and they're the 4 seed.
Yeah.
You feel better about them, but they're not as close to the top of the West as we think. I think they spent maybe a day and a half at the top of the Western Conference. Should they just be getting themselves ready to be in that 4-5 matchup? Or do you think they should still be focusing on, with how many games we have left, trying to break through that Denver, OKC, Minnesota top three?
It's really all about health. And I know that's not what the NBA wants to hear, but this next month is all about making sure that Kawhi Leonard is, his knees are good, his back is good. And if they don't have Kawhi, then they're cooked, right? So I think the last month of the season, whether it's taking games off or just getting that extra ramp up time and not come back too early for trying to force games, whether it's on national TV or not, the whole legacy of this team is going to depend on how far they make it in the postseason. And so I think for the next month, we're going to see probably Kawhi in and out of the lineup. Russell Westbrook hopefully coming back soon. I don't think that they can depend on a lot of the 9-10 guys on the roster. So need those guys. But it's going to be, you know, the case around the league with the Minnesota Timberwolves. That's the funny thing about the outcome last night is, if anyone wants to play the injury card, it's the Timberwolves. They lose Kat, and then the rest of their guys are banged up, and then Anthony Edwards just takes over. And what's interesting to me, who was guarding Anthony Edwards for most of that game? It wasn't Paul George. And that seems like something that they want to do maybe postseason. They're keeping in the back pocket, maybe a little bit of gamesmanship, maybe a little chess, where maybe we'll see this team down the line. We don't want to show all our cards yet, but when Kawhi goes out, you expect Paul George to line up, and Anthony Edwards definitely lined up.
That man last night, he was being interviewed by Stephanie Reddy in the post game.
Best interview in the NBA, by the way.
That look, man, I'm telling you, the NBA is missing the boat. They need to drape that man around the American flag before the Olympics and just make him the face of the future of USA NBA basketball. Like, seriously, he's delightful. And, you know, there's some other things about him too, but I think that just goes with like the entire color of the Ant-Man package. But that man time last night, Stephanie Reddy said, hey, you know, what did you see out there? That man basically said, when Kawhi left the game, I saw food. These dudes are food. That, like you could go on to the minutiae and everything else, but the bottom line of it, Tom, he looked at America dead in his face and said, nobody can guard me, and I love it.
And it's not like he said that against the Pistons or the Spurs or the Charlotte Hornets. He said that about the Clippers, right? Like, this is a championship contender, and he's like, they can't guard me. And I love his bravado. I love his sense of place. And even though literally his sense of place is off, I was covering I was on the broadcast for the Blazers game a couple games ago, and yeah, he missed the tip.
Did we ever find out why?
He forgot that he was supposed to be out on the floor. Like, he was doing some stuff on the side and then just like ran out of time and like forgot, oh yeah, I got to be out there. So like my producer's in my ear and he's like, hey, Tom, why is Ant on the sideline? He's not, have you ever seen this before? I'm like, what is going on? And it's because he just missed the clock. And so he did that again last night where it's just like, where is Ant? And I love this like storyline of this dude who like doesn't really show up to class, but he still gets A's. You know what I'm saying? And yeah, he just, when it matters, he's there. And that's all that matters. And like Chris Finch can bench the guy or be like, hey, you know, in college when a guy like shows up late to class or misses the team flight or late to the team flight, the coach might, you know, bench him for the first half or whatever to send a message. You're not sending a message with Ant. Like, he's your dude. And especially with these injuries, and I think Naz Reid, as close of a facsimile to Kat as you're going to find in the league, he's stepping up. But Anthony Edwards, it's his team, and in many sense of the word, it's his league right now.
I'm not being hyperbolic when I say this, Tom. Seriously, I'm not being hyperbolic, and people will think that we're being hyperbolic here. There's a way that certain players move, like their gait, how easy they get from spot A to spot B, how easy they go end to end, that reminds you of someone. And we've had a lot of quote unquote next Michael Jordans, right? We've had a lot of them. Nobody moves like Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan moved in a certain way, like that was just it was like water, it was very fluid, yeah, right?
Vince was the same way. I know what you're saying.
And yes.
I was hoping you were going to do that runway to that. So I'm like, yo, but there's this other thing that he does, Vinny. His D-cell, his breaks is crazy. Crazy. He does this thing where he does like a Euro step in the lane. Like he's going a mile, 100 miles an hour. And boom, he stops. And the whole defense is in the front row.
Yep.
And he gets a wide open layup. Like you wonder why Luka Doncic is shooting 86% from the restricted area, number one in the league. It's the D-cell. He and mm-hmm. Ant's D-cell, when they go from 60 to zero, not zero to 60, plenty of guys can go zero to 60 faster than those dudes, but their 60 to zero is unparalleled. And that's why they get these open looks at the rim where it's like, he's laughing. He's giggling at these dudes as he sends them into the front row and he just takes a wide open layup. Like Ant is, it's unbelievable watching how good he is at this age. And we need that because the American born homegrown talent, like, it's an inter- we'll probably talk about this later. It's an international league in many sense of the, in a lot of sense. When you got like Ant Edwards, man, he's the next, and he might even be the now.
Yeah, because you know we placed a lot of American hopes in Ja Morant, who likes to play with things, and we placed a lot of hope in Zion Williamson, who likes to be around things. So. I don't know. Anthony Edwards might be it. Hey, he might be better than both of those dudes anyway. Like, right? Like, it, that might be the case regardless. And think about this. As much as that dude loves playing basketball, the draft eval on him was, that dude doesn't like playing basketball. Shows how much we know. Or shows how much the evaluators know. Like, I've never looked at that dude and said, ah, man, he don't look like he like playing basketball. Like, some of this stuff is absolutely ridiculous. We got to be very careful about some of the labels that we place on guys. But the interesting point the interesting point you said, Tom, about the D-cell, Luka's not even going that fast and he's slowing down. Ant is going very fast. He's going Corvette speed. Like, I remember asking Jason Kidd about aging, and he was like, it's not getting from zero to 100. It's the slowing down that's the hard thing for the older players. For Ant, I just love seeing him go end to end. Like, there's a point, I think, in a Lakers game the other day where LeBron was literally trying to decide, should I chase down this block? You know what I mean? Like, you could tell that he was trying to measure, should I chase down this block? And then Ant did what I call pushing the S button, that sport button in your car. He just pushed the sport button. He left LeBron in the dust. And Anthony Davis didn't even have, like, the torque to go for a dunk. He was just like, oh, this fool is jumping. And that is so, like, that's aesthetically beautiful to me from just watching basketball. And I think we need more of that.
Yeah, and the Pacers thing, what you're talking about is the athletic gifts and the way that he's making Anthony Davis and LeBron James look like mere mortals out there. Like that, no one's really ever done that in the league, right? Anthony Davis and LeBron James are considered the most athletic of their generational talents. And when he's leaving them in the dust, then you got to really check yourself and be like, what are we watching here? Secondly, that Indiana Pacers block, I don't think people quite understand how crazy it is, not that he got that high, but that he got that high in the 48th minute. Like, most players are dragging.
Yeah.
And they look at that block and they're like, you know what? I'm not going for it. I don't have the legs to do that. He did it, and he said he jumped the highest he's ever jumped in his life, and that was the 48th minute of a game. So, Vinny, like, we talk about athleticism, but there's also this other piece of it is want to.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to get up there and block that shot. A lot of players want to, they can't. He does both. He can and he wants to. And that is where the magic happens. That's where stars are made. Superstars are made is when you have the ability and you also have the want to. Because a lot of players will look at that and be like, yeah, someone else got it. I'm good. I'm back here. I don't want to hurt myself. I'm good. He does not care. He is banging his head on the rim and the backboard to save his team when it's not even his cover. So I love this kid. I love the drive. And, you know, we heard that a lot about other players in the league where do they really love the game? And he's got it, man. He's got it. And I think the NBA has to play the greatest hits or the big media markets, of course, because they got Boston, LA, New York. But Minnesota and San Antonio with Wemby, I just kind of feel like they should be on national TV every opportunity they can because this is next. right? Anthony Edwards and Victor Wembanyama, that is the league as soon as next year.
Yeah, it is as soon as next year. It's as soon for Ant, as soon as April and May. Like, that is what I'm really looking forward to, is the playoffs and seeing how America opens its eyes towards this dude who plays a lot like this player that America really loved. Now, moving on, Tom Haberstroh. In the span of a month, we had a bunch of dudes scoring 60. We had Joel Embiid score 70. Karl Towns score 62. Luka Doncic score 73. Devin Booker and Steph Curry both crossed the 60.
I think you dropped 50 at one point, right? That was
no, that was a clean 45. It was just a clean 45.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. You stay humble. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. It's a clean 45, right? So, and that was from January 22nd to February 3rd. It's the big time scoring binge, right? Since then, or since the All-Star break, scoring has gone down 3.8 points a game. I think I saw it on Steiny's Substack, Mark Stein's Substack. If you haven't checked that out, go check that out. You and Steiny and Ethan Strauss have all written about the scoring dip, 3.8 points per game, which is a huge number from the All-Star break to now. Small sample size, but a big drop, the biggest drop in league history. You attribute that on your Substack to lack of free throws. Do you think, A, that's an anomaly, or B, do you think that's sort of more consistency in officiating?
Yeah, so from talking around the league, it's officiating. The coaches, the players, the referee experts that I talk to are noticing a definite change in the way that shooting fouls are adjudicated in the league. Anecdotally, that's what they say. Is the 50-50 calls that used to go a defensive foul are now either a no call or it's an offensive foul. So one coach said they got rid of the bullshit in the league. And that is what I think a lot of people in the league feel like the first couple months of the season. The defenses didn't have a chance.
Yeah.
And so this is a market correction. In Stein's report, he went to the league and asked them, hey, is there anything to this, the officiating angle? Did you guys, I don't know exactly what he asked the league.
Right.
But the league addressed it and said there's no directive from us to the officials to change the way that they officiate. Now, I get it. It's kind of what they have to say because without a point of emphasis memo out to the league,
right.
We haven't heard of anything, any changes like that. So for them, it might be a soft indication. The kind of film or the clips that they show the officials on a nightly report, it might not be like, hey, we need to like slow down on these calls. It might be a little bit softer. But the numbers bear out that shooting fouls are way down. And when I wrote on my Substack, like the NBA scoring is crashing, it's because it is like falling like a waterfall, the shooting fouls per minute in the NBA. So you can go about it two ways. Hey, this is just a statistical anomaly, which is what Mark Stein said the league is asserting, is that this is just random noise. I don't think it is. I don't think the teams think it is. And I think it has big impacts on the teams that play physical. If physicality is back, Vinny, there are certain teams that like to play physical and will rough you up and play JLR basketball in the playoffs. That is, I think, a big talking point, is which teams does this benefit. But we, man... The Knicks, have you seen the Knicks scoring recently?
They have turned the clock back to 1994.
Man, it is crazy out here because we got the Knicks holding opponents in three straight games to under 80 points. That's the first time since 2012 that's happened, that a team has held an opponent under 80 points in three straight games. So we're dialing back the clock, not to like 3 years ago, but I mean, we haven't seen it in over a decade, this right. kind of low scoring. And last night, I checked this in Vegas. The unders were cashing 6 out of the 7 games. The reason why I wrote that article 2 weeks ago about the NBA scoring crashing, Vinny, is because I noticed from my guy Ben Fox, who has a Substack as well, he's been covering NBA betting or sports betting for the last decade at ESPN and elsewhere. And he noticed that since the All-Star break, unders were cashing at 70%+. Usually that's 50%. But Vegas was slow to this. That's how I know something's up. When Vegas is slow to a market trend, that's when I'm like, man, something unusual is happening. And last thing, usually the NBA scoring increases in the second half of the year after the All-Star break. Mm. This is a total anomaly from that.
I was going to ask, and that answers the question. I was going to ask, is this, could this possibly be a matter of tired teams maybe not playing as, you know, pushing it as much, you know, as far as offensively, not necessarily conserving their bodies, but just, you know, some level of correction, even in coaching? Because a guy like you just mentioned, the Knicks, Tom Thibodeau, who has long been thought of as one of the premier defensive coaches in the league, I wonder how much that plays into all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a great question. The idea is if there is fatigue, that usually shows up on the defensive end.
Okay.
So the reason why I think we see a lot of scoring uptick in the second half of the year, typically in the NBA season, Kevin Pelton's talked about this too, is this trend usually goes up. Offensive rating, teams get more efficient at the end of the season. I think a lot of it has to do with defenses either checked out or new players, G League players coming up. They're getting a look at their younger players for next season. You know, teams go from, hey, we're going to chase the playoffs to, hey, let's look at what we got for next year. Maybe get a preview of our summer league team. And so when you have that lack of NBA talent, or at least starter level talent, it usually shows up defensively, is that it's just harder to defend when you got new guys who never played with each other in a new system that they don't know. And the coach is trying to scramble, like, who's this guy? So I think when we see this scoring dip, what the alarm bells are going off in my head is this isn't normal. We don't usually see this. And the individual point totals, as Mark Stein pointed out, way down. And as Ethan reported, like, players and coaches, GM types, they are all saying, from his perspective and what I'm hearing too, something's up and something changed. And whether that's part of the negotiating deal with the TV deal, whether that's aesthetically they're hearing from fans, we don't like 140 to 146, or they feel like it's too easy to score 70 or 60. Like 50 is the new 20.
Yeah,
maybe they didn't like that, and maybe they're trying to recalibrate the system. But it's big, and I think coaches are now trying to figure out how do I coach my guys on how to draw fouls now, because it is important. It's a huge part of the game, is coaching your players on how to draw fouls, and now the calculus is changing.
Yeah, I mean, I remember there was a point of emphasis, maybe 2 years ago, where they wanted to get, like, the lack of a better phrase, the Trae Young, James Harden, you know, drawing of fouls out of the game. And it felt like it lasted for maybe about 2 months, and then it went right back up. So as we spin it forward, and you made a great point that I want to come back to, Tom, you said it benefits some teams more than others, especially when we get playoff basketball around the corner. What teams do you think that it really benefits? Because we already see the New York Knicks. They're going to just bludgeon you and beat you the hell up. What other teams do you see benefiting from this?
Well, it's the 90s throwback teams, right? It's the Miami Heat. They don't block shots. They just block you from getting anywhere. They're last in block shots in the NBA, and they're one of the best defensive teams. It's because they play physical, and they guard their yard, right? So they make sure that they're going to beat that matchup, and they're going to go to zone. If they don't feel like they have a plus matchup or they want to hide certain defenders, Tyler Hero, Duncan Robinson, et cetera, they're going to go zone, and usually a zone – teams don't know what they're doing, and they usually settle for jump shots. And that's a win for Miami, is if you can't get into the paint and drive and kick, we're going to win more times than not. And so Miami, I feel like this does help them. But it does hurt on the other side, is Jimmy Butler loves to, you know, go to the line. And he's one of the most physical offensive players too. So
yes,
I look at James Harden. This is going to hurt James Harden, because the rap on him is, yeah, you can get your 11 free throws a game in the regular season, but come playoff time, when the referees tend to swallow their whistle and make sure there's more physicality allowed, James Harden tends to flame out. Same with Joel Embiid. This does not help those players who rely on getting 10 free throw trips a game to get their 30. So I think Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he's been actually getting to the line quite a bit here as we're seeing that crash. He's still doing it. He grabbed 30 last night, and it was kind of cheap how he did it. But I would say Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, that's another name that I'm wondering, does he become less potent? Does he become less of a heliocentric force where everything revolves around him if he's not getting those foul calls? when he goes with that pump fake and everyone jumps. So we'll see, but keep in mind the players who love to get to the free throw line. I think that's going to be important. And also defensively, the teams that love to play physical are even going to get better here in the playoffs.
Like a time I had talked to Joe Dumars, maybe like a month and a half ago, and he was just talking about it going to the first Denver-Boston game. That was like a 92-90 game. That was one of those games where Jason Tatum missed a jumper to send the game into overtime, pick a game, because that's seemingly whatever Boston has a close game. Jason Tatum misses some type of shot to send the game into overtime or to give him a win. That seems to be the book on him. But I get the feeling that the competition committee is going to look at something this offseason to maybe bring the sliders down just a little bit. Now, if you're saying that this is an extreme anomaly, do you think this is a sample size the competition committee will look at and say, okay, we've fixed it with whatever our points of emphasis were, with whatever market corrections that were made in the last 30% of this season? Or do you think they're going to go full wholesale, we're going to take a look at everything from a competition committee standpoint, regardless of what happens right now?
Great question. I think it's kind of a soft launch here. Is I've noticed defensive 3 seconds numbers are down. They're not calling defensive 3 seconds as much these days. And teams are utilizing the illegal defense. They're in the paint, right? They're 2.9ing, and then they're also 3.9ing, right? So I think when you look at that fact that defensive 3 seconds numbers are down this month and since the All-Star break, and that shooting fouls are down, it suggests to me that you're seeing a lot of teams that are camping out in the paint and making sure that, they are physical and they're not going to have to deal with an easy or a cheap foul call. And teams are leveraging that. So I think it's a really good sample size for the competition committee to see what this kind of NBA looks like. If we do, as you said, put the sliders down, dial it back a little bit. I will also point out, no one wants to watch free throws. You kind of tune out. You're looking at your phone. Also, it extends the broadcast, right? So when you have a free throw decline, you're also seeing a decline in the length of the games, which is a plus. I think if you're going to a TV partner and saying, hey, we can go from 2 hours and 15 minutes down to like 2:05, that's a win. Because if you can get that closer to that 2-hour window, I think the networks like that. And I would say, when you're dealing with the scoring totals, like you said, is I think Joe Dumars, or might have been Adam Silver, had said, I think it was Joe actually, I don't care about the score or how many points are being scored. I just want a good game.
Right.
Right. If you have 150 points or scoring at a high rate, the higher the scoring rate, the more chance they're blowouts. If you have a lower scoring rate and it has a lower chance of it being a blowout, it's going to be just naturally, just it's a law of math that if you have lower variance in the scoring, you're going to have tighter games.
Right.
And
right.
So by dialing back the sliders and making it harder on the offense, you're naturally going to have, like we saw with the Sixers and Knicks the other night, 79-73. But if you extend that game a little bit longer, a pace goes higher, you're going to see that 6-point lead, widen a little bit as we keep going. So by dialing back the sliders, you might actually be making more competitive games. And I think that's what they want, is more competitive games. And the more scoring there is, the more variance there is, the more 3-point shooting there is, the more likelihood we're going to see a game get out of hand by the third quarter.
That's a great point. And that's why Tom is here. We're going to be right back in a moment to pay some bills with Tom Capistro. Back here on The Good Word with Tom Haberstroh. Tom, the most intriguing matchup right now in terms of present and future and that dreaded L word, legacy. I hate the word legacy, mind you. I hate it. But that best matchup right now in terms of how the present and the future is Nikola Jokic and Giannis Antetokounmpo. Like, we don't think about these guys as being the torchbearers because we are still very much in the LeBron era, the Steph era, the Kevin Durant era, and we're waiting on somebody to take the torch from. We've been waiting on Zion and Ja Morant and all those guys. But the winner of the last several MVPs, two of the last three finals MVPs have been these guys. And it seems like Jokic is the sort of far and away, I won't say far and away, but he's the prohibitive favorite, would you say, for MVP this year. And I feel like this year could break the tie of best player of this generation, whatever this generation is. Do you kind of see it the same way, that this is this sort of unspoken of rivalry that's right before our eyes?
So the resumes are, there's a rivalry with the resumes.
Right.
I don't think we have any iconic, maybe I'm wrong and I'm missing something, any iconic games where they're going at each other relentlessly, because usually it's Brooke and then Giannis at the four. But I would say in terms of like superiority and having a better resume and the better like claim to the throne, like if Jokic wins MVP, but the Bucks win the championship,
ooh,
man, I think it's going to be Giannis, right? I think what we give a lot more credit to, you're the best player in the league after winning a championship. You see a lot of it in Jokic. I feel like before he won the championship last year, there were a lot of doubters out there, a lot of people who were skeptical of whether he had it, capital I. And now we know that he can do that. He can do that and be that dude in the finals, in the Western Conference finals, and nobody can stop him. For me, I think if I'm going to pick one going forward or one right now, I'm leaning towards Jokic. And that was really hard. I remember writing this thing about Giannis Antetokounmpo a couple years ago for his MVP. And I said, much to the ire of the Houston Rockets fans, because they were going for James Harden that year, I said, Giannis Antetokounmpo has the most unassisted dunks in the NBA, and that's why he's MVP. And the reason why I said that, it might be an obscure stat, but I think it exemplifies why Giannis is so dominant and so unguardable, is he can create a dunk out of nothing.
Mm.
You can't stay in front of him because of his Euro step, his quickness, his handle, and you can't prevent him because he's so powerful and strong and long to dunk the ball. He is a one-man fast break every time he gets the ball. And so he is a wrecking ball. And if you build an offense, Vinny, you're like, how do I get a dunk? It's almost impossible to get a guy putting the ball into the hoop physically. It's really hard to do that. But Giannis does it single-handedly. However, there's one way to stop Giannis, and that's getting him to the free throw line. And I'm sorry, but I get real nervous, Vinny. If you need a loophole from the referees to not call a 10-second violation, I feel like it's got to be Jokic. Like, I feel more comfortable having Jokic in a big moment making the right play. And I just feel like he has fewer weaknesses that you can point to and be like, yeah, you can't, there's nothing you can do. I was talking to another coach who was like, I don't know if there is a blueprint to stop Jokic. You can't foul him. You can't get in his face and like try to get up in his grill, because he's going to go by you with his footwork, and you can't play off him because then you're just giving him a lob to Aaron Gordon. To me, Jokic is the superior player right now, and also going forward, I don't have the injury question of like, he doesn't need his athleticism to continue playing at an MVP level going forward because of his jump shot and his footwork. Giannis, I feel like those two things, free throws and the athleticism, I just feel like going forward, I think Jokic is the guy.
Yeah, I think I will have to be very careful, because John knows this, because John was on a podcast with me a couple of weeks ago. We had Jerry Greenberg from NBA on TNT on. And I had said something that, of course, wound up not getting aggregated, but it wound up getting chopped and screwed. And the Denver Hive got
a little upset.
And I said that Giannis winning another MVP seems unlikely because of the stink around him due to the Adrian Griffin firing.
Totally agree with that, by the way.
And Jared Greenberg cut me off and said, no, no, no. It's because Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Nikola Jokic are playing so great. I said, two things can be true at the same time. I said, I'm not taking anything away from how great those guys are playing and how they've lapped the field. I'm also saying that some people will look at Giannis and say, traditionally, if your coach gets fired, sometimes we make these decisions really early on in the season. If your team is struggling and everything else, or your team isn't fulfilling expectations, then we will X you out of that conversation. that said, Nikola Jokic is probably the most, this is how I will describe the difference, Tom. I feel like Giannis is the most irresistible force in basketball. Like, he makes his way to plays. Like, that play in the finals against DeAndre Ayton, which was the best defensive play I've ever seen in my life, where you're guarding the man and the ball, and then the ball goes over your head, and then you pick a spot on the backboard, and you just...
Iconic. Right. Iconic.
And you're on a bad knee. Remember that. He's on a bad knee, and that's the knee that he jumped off
it
of to
like
get
this.
There.
It went like this. His knee went like this, and he's doing that, Vinny. Crazy.
Yeah. So, and I think that there's an element of, if there's a big moment, Giannis can make that play. I think Nikola Jokic is the most inevitable force in basketball. Like, when he gets the ball at whatever point on the floor, like, there's never, you hear of like hot zones and cold zones. I don't feel like there's ever a zone or a spot on the floor where Jokic gets the ball where you say, okay, we feel comfortable that he has the ball here because he's not as deadly here. Nah, he's deadly everywhere. You know what I mean, Tom?
Yeah.
He's literally deadly everywhere. And I remember someone on Twitter asked me, who would you pick to defend Nikola Jokic? And I was like, oh, the answer's easy. Hakeem Duncan. Real easy. That's how easy the answer is. You give me Tim Duncan's, like, can't move him. Like, yeah. the base of Tim Duncan and everything else that he has with the hands of Hakeem Olajuwon and the timing of Hakeem Olajuwon. That human being doesn't exist. That's how you stop him. He doesn't exist at all. So,
defensively, I want to say that's got to be Giannis. And then I look at the standings and the defensive efficiency, and I'm like, wait a minute, the Nuggets have the best better defense of those two. And how do we reconcile that? Is it all Adrian Griffin, or is it just a matter of the Nuggets are a championship team? They know what they're doing. They got the personnel. Whatever gap there is between Jokic and Giannis as an individual defender. And look, Giannis is a DPOY. I'm not arguing that Jokic is a DPOY here. But it's not showing in the scoring defense. It's not showing in the standings. If Jokic does have that huge gap, how do you explain that the Milwaukee Bucks are a middling team defensively, and yet Jokic's team is top five, top 10?
I don't know how I can exactly answer that, but I do think that you pointed to it. Milwaukee's a completely different defensive team at the point of attack compared to what they used to be. Secondly, Nikola Jokic has gone through this, I won't say metamorphosis, but I definitely feel like last year's playoff run emphasized to him the importance of his own individual and team defense, plus the fact that he's got remarkably quick hands. So he can get not only get his hands on balls, but he can obstruct your view. He can make those passing lanes that much more difficult to get to. And I'll say this, as I pick Jokic like you pick Jokic, but if we see Giannis and Jokic in the finals this year, I won't be mad. People will say that there is a battle between Jokic and Embiid. And they will rightfully say that Embiid is a defensive vortex, right? Just the size, the shot blocking, all that, right? And they'll say Embiid's a better defensive player. I will say yes. And you will say Embiid is the guy that scores 70 points. Embiid is the guy that averages 35, like having one of the greatest scoring runs from his position in the history of the game. And you can make the argument that he's a comparable offensive player, maybe even a better offensive player. I wouldn't say that, but I know some people would. So some people would say, if you're giving Embiid the benefit of the doubt on offense, he's the better offensive player and the better defensive player. Who's the better player? And I'm still going to say Nikola Jokic. Why? Because I got eyes. You know what I mean? Like you can break it down, but the answer is still the answer. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And I will say this. I think I would vote Shea for MVP.
Really?
I would go Shea for MVP. Even if we're talking Giannis and Jokic, in my head, I'm like, but I don't even know if I would pick either of them for MVP. Because what Shea does offensively, we know this. But defensively, he's leading the league in steals by a mile. And the Thunder, 22 average age Thunder, are top five defensively this year. And a lot of it is because he takes care of the ball offensively and he creates a ton of turnovers defensively. And there's the old Allen Iverson aspect of this is like, you know, he used to get a bad rap for hunting for steals and gambling at the expense of his defense.
Right.
And so maybe, you know, you recalibrate that steals aren't exactly a go-to stat. But what I do know is they're better defensively with Shea on the floor. Their turnover rate defensively is sky high. So he does a lot of things to create those turnovers and steals. And I would also point to this. Steals is an offensive stat too. Steals get you in transition. Yes. Steals, when Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, here's a stat for you. When Shea Gilgeous-Alexander gets a steal, they have an offensive rating of 147 the next possession. So when he's getting that steal, it's not just, oh, he made a stop. It's that he's getting a bucket on the other end, whether it's him getting it or Chet or Jay. I think when you look at this Shea Gilgeous-Alexander season, they're at the top of the Western Conference. The story of the team is that he's leading this team as the one lone adult on that roster. And he's got the defensive numbers to back it up, the offensive numbers to back it up. And I just feel like Jokic is in cruise control. Like if he's not in the fifth gear, he's more like in the third or fourth gear. And I think he's okay with that. I just feel like Shea, everything to me, the numbers, the standings, the story, both sides of the ball, it's Shea Gilgeous-Alexander's year.
I think part of the MVP, for me, at least historically, since I've been a voter, and I've been a voter since 2011, and I take that thing really seriously. Part of winning the MVP is wanting to win the MVP, is the going forward. More than it is, you know, narrative and everything else. The reason Embiid, and I didn't make my MVP vote on Embiid until maybe the last two or three weeks of the season. I wasn't actually leaning Jokic because Jokic had powered down. I was actually leaning Giannis last year. And then Giannis missed a few games, and I think he wanted to be in at 62, and we hadn't had an MVP play that few amount of games, you know, to win MVP in an 82-game season. So I agree with you, especially if Shea's going for it. If he's going for it and he wants it, and luckily, Tom, this year doesn't have the icky conversation around it, like any level of that ickiness, hopefully maybe we've learned our lesson. But if going for the MVP means something, if it means something to Shea, if it means something to him, you might have to think
about that. What does
that
mean? What is wanting it or meaning wanting the MVP? What does that look like
to you? It's in the effort. You talked about Jokic being in cruise control, and basically he could put up 25, 10, and 10 in his sleep. But there's an element to, not only am I elevating my team, but you can see me elevating my game, and I'm going for it. Not playing selfishly. You know what I mean? But because you mentioned earlier when we talked about fatigue playing a part in teams and how they perform at this point in the season, if you're fighting off fatigue to actually go for it individually because you want it, not like in a selfish way, but you are elevating your game in that way, like that to me means something.
Yeah, and I feel like he wants it. Are you saying he doesn't want it, or are you saying?
No. I think there's an element that Shea wants it. I don't know if as a voting block we are paying enough attention. I think it's a matter of like an Academy Award. Like Denzel Washington will win an Academy Award for Training Day, but he wouldn't win it for Malcolm X. You know what I mean? Like that sort of thing. Like you're going to get it sometimes after you should. And a couple days ago, I had Shaquille O'Neal on for an interview. And Shaq said the finals matchup that we need is Milwaukee versus Denver for the future and present of basketball.
Ooh, interesting.
Right?
Yeah. Well, I feel like OKC is going to be here for a while. Denver's going to be here for a while. The Milwaukee Bucks with Dame and Giannis and Brooke as a core, and Chris Middleton's been banged up this year. Yep. It feels like it's now or never for them. Because if it crumbles, and there's a fissure with Doc Rivers again, with you know what how things ended in Philly, that could blow up real fast, real fast. There's a combustibility factor with the Milwaukee Bucks, with the pressure. I know Giannis extended already, but Damian Lillard wasn't number one on his list, the Milwaukee Bucks. If they crumble, if they're early out, it feels like they're not going to be back in the same form next year. Things might be different next year. That I don't feel like is the same with Denver and OKC. I feel like they're going to be a powerhouse for years to come. Whereas the Clippers and the Bucks, it feels like now or never. And if we do get that Milwaukee Denver matchup, it's going to be so great for a marketing standpoint because of the Twin Towers, because Giannis versus Jokic. We don't really have that with the Boston Celtics, right? We don't really have that. As much as Bam is a singular talent for the Miami Heat, if the Miami Heat get there in the finals again, it's going to get that, you know, repeat juice of them going against the Denver Nuggets. I just think that Shaq's right. From an NBA standpoint, Milwaukee Bucks with Doc Rivers, Giannis, and Dame, the storyline around Dame as a capital L word you hate, that's going to be an amazing storyline. Is Dame in the finals for the first time? Doc back in the finals since 2008. This is, so 2010. I'm rooting for
Doc was in the finals in 2010.
Oh, 2010. Yeah. Winning the finals in 2008 back in since 2010. So yeah, man, that's Jokic versus Giannis. I hope that's where the league is. It's great, but you know where I stand on this. It's going to be Chet and Wemby. Like before we know it, Chet
skinny
and
ball.
Wemby are
skinny ball. That's what I call it. I call it skinny ball. And we call Big Vic here, Big Slim. We don't call him Wemby. We call him Big Slim is the official name for Victor Wembanyama here on The Good Word. Tom, one last thing, of course, before we get out of here. Every week that we have you on, we're going to have a random category and we're going to have each of our top five lists. Producer John, open your mic and you're going to ask us about the category. So what is the category, Producer John?
The cereals? Category? We're doing cereals today? What are we doing?
No, it's going to be something less fun than cereals, but more fun for this podcast. This week, in honor of March Madness getting underway over the course of the next few days, we decided to go with kind of a mashup of two different categories we were discussing. Your top five favorite college players that never made it in the league.
Made it.
Now, I did not read that as player died. So that to me took out like Lynn Bias. You know what I mean? Like that would have been a guy that, all right, Lynn Bias would have been number one on the list, that sort of thing. But I'm with you. So Tom, since you're the guest, you give me your five and then I'll give you mine.
All right. So I'll start with five. I grew up in Connecticut. I wasn't a UConn fan, but Khalid El-Amin was so fun, dude. Yo, I don't know, man. It's just point guards, small point guards are going to probably populate this list because of the size factor going into the league. You're playing amongst boys and then you go play with men, right? Yep. You're going against giants at the next level. And so it's harder for the Khalid El-Amins to make it into the league. And so number five, I got Khalid El-Amin from UConn, the Husky.
Now, it's funny because I just sent John a picture of my list, right? The first name on my list, Khalid El-Amin. I joke with you not. Small, pudgy point guards. Well, for me, let's be perfectly honest.
Husky
here.
Point guard. Yeah. Husky. Yeah.
Husky. A little, you know, yeah. He's a little husky.
Rotund. Little
rotund.
Rounder.
Right. Yeah. Like if Kyle Lowry was slightly shorter, right? Like that sort of thing. And I'll be perfectly honest here. I'm a lifelong Duke hater. So this list is heavy on Duke killers, so to speak.
Okay. Oh.
So Khalid El-Amin is number one on my list. I'll give you number two on my list. He was Mike Bibby's backcourt mate at Arizona. He was the most outstanding. I think he was the most outstanding player in the 97 national championship.
Is this Miles Simon?
Miles Simon. Mm. Think about it. Mike Bibby, Miles Simon, Jason Terry. And the dude that didn't make it in the NBA was Miles Simon. The dude that came off the bench was Jason Terry. Make that make sense. And I wasn't even rooting for Arizona that year. I was rooting for Kentucky because that had, you know, Derek Anderson. And that team had won the national title the year before. And that game went into overtime. Like, that Arizona team was spectacular. Miles Simon was spectacular. Who's your second guy?
All right, so I started with five, so we have flip-flopped. So you got Khalid at number one?
No, I just got him written down. No order. Just
Oh, no order. Okay. So I got Khalid El-Amin at five. I got Adam Morrison at four.
Ooh.
Adam Morrison at Gonzaga was, it felt like something different. I love the mustache. He looked like he was at like a, I don't know, like a Strokes concert or something like that. Like this dude, it didn't really fit the prototype of what a guy that dominant at that size should be able to do. And he flamed, it was an iconic moment when he lost in the tournament and he was crying and everything. I really thought he was going to do things in the league. And so did the Bobcats. And maybe I'm biased because I'm here in Charlotte, but it felt like to me Adam Morrison was destined to do better things in the league, and he flamed out. So I got Adam Morrison at 4, and I want to hear your take on this one at number 3.
Go ahead.
Michigan State, Sean Respert.
I was thinking about Sean Respert. He could shoot the blood out of the ball,
oh,
man.
Oh, God. I was talking about my brother. So when we got that prompt about top 5, I have 2 older brothers. So most of these guys on this list are like before my time, because they would always talk and like, Sean Respert, dude, he's going to be the real deal.
Right.
I went back and I was thinking about him and what he could have been at the league, and watching him, he was so cold, man. Like pulling up from Steph range,
yep,
routinely, and the shooting, he averaged what, like 26 or 27 his senior year?
He was huge.
Huge at Michigan State. And, you know, of all the guys that made it out of Michigan State, Sean Respert, I think he had like a couple years in the league. I think he was the number 8 pick. And man, Sean Respert was unbelievable.
I want to say he maybe had a kidney issue.
It was a stomach cancer, which is a crazy story. He didn't tell anyone. He didn't want to tell anyone that he had stomach cancer. He told like his coach, Izzo, and a couple other people that he was dealing with a tumor and he was sick. And I'm like, yo, can you imagine that story happening? There's no way that doesn't get out now. There's no way.
That is so wild. That is Sean Respert. He was so, and I'm not a Michigan State fan at all, but that dude was so cold.
He's from Detroit, maybe?
Yes, he is from Detroit.
Man,
he's from
play.
The east side. He's from the east side of Detroit, too. So give me your 2 and your 1.
All right. AC Law is on there. Another small guy who just in the tournament against Louisville, just like, man, such a cold-blooded assassin.
Yes.
He's number 2 on my list. And then number 1, if you know me, I got to rep the Demon Deacons, and this guy has a special place in my soul for the most cold-blooded move in ACC history.
Oh, yes.
Randolph Childress,
yes,
in the ACC tournament.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Averaged 36 in the tournament, won it that year, and did Jeff McGinnis dirty, crossing him up. And when Jeff McGinnis got on his skates and he fell down, it wasn't that he just hit the shot. He did the most iconic move, I would say, of my childhood watching ACC basketball. And I was a huge UNC fan at the time. I went to Wake, so this was kind of at the nexus of that, is he went with this, get up, and he drained that 3 in front of the Tar Heel bench. I'm telling you, when I say that was the most ridiculous play of my childhood, I thought he was going to be unbelievable at the next league, and injuries and just didn't work out for him at the next level. But special place in my heart for Randolph Childress and what he did in that ACC tournament, man.
That was Tim Duncan's freshman year, mind you, right? And Randolph Childress, I want to say he went 8 in the draft, same draft as Sean Respert, if I am correct, if I'm going to my draft geekdom. And I want to say maybe he was traded on draft night from Detroit. Can't exactly remember how. But I gave you my first 2, Khalil Alameen, Miles Simon. I'm going to go local here. I'm from Detroit, a Michigan guy, Lou Bullock, who had one of the sweetest jump shots. Louis Bullock, we called him Lou. Lou had one of the sweetest jump shots you would ever see. He was a part of that. They weren't like the Fab Five. They were kind of like Fab Five light. Like after those guys, it was Lou Bullock. It was Gerard Ward. It was Maceo Bastin, Maurice Taylor, the late Robert Tractor Trailer. I can't believe I named all 5 of those dudes. Sometimes I get into the geek bag and I'm like, all right, cool. That dude had the smoothest, sweetest jump shot ever, right? Number 4 for me, Anderson Hunt from UNLV.
Wow, these are deep cuts, man. Yeah.
Deep cuts, baby. Anderson Hunt, a Detroit kid, okay? So that's kind of from southwest side of Detroit. He torched Duke in that national title game in 1990. Like, that was a team that had Greg Anthony, Stacey Augman, Liddell Echols, Larry Johnson. Larry Johnson was the player of the year. Like, that team was just so great. And it's funny, I'm going back to the ACC for my last one, because he used to throw lobs to Vince Carter, and he used to wear the super dope Nikes. North Carolina point guard Ed Cota. That man was a walking East Bay magazine. What shoes does Ed Cota have on today, and what shoes can I not get? Dude was just spectacular. Like, you knew part of it. You knew that he wasn't going to be like great in the league, even at a young age. But you thought, man, this dude is killing it at this level. Ed Cota. I'm big on the point guards, and the shooters. So my five, Khalil Al-Amin, Miles Simon, Lewis Bullock, Anderson Hunt, and Ed Cota. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is Tom Haberstroh. He'll be back with us 2 weeks from now on Wednesday, Wednesdays with Stroh. And thanks to producer John and the entire team that works hard behind the scenes, Jake and Dan. They'll be back for another episode of No Cap Room tomorrow. And we'll be back right here on Monday for another episode of The Good Word. Until then, everybody be safe.